We're at the Paul F. Glenn Symposium on the Biology of Aging. We're actually in the Four Seasons Biltmore in Santa Barbara. At the end of a long day, talking about genetic and molecular basis of longevity and aging with Gary Ruvkun. Nice to see you again from Massachusetts General Hospital, Harvard Medical School, Lasker Award winner for RNAi. And I wanted to talk to you about two things. One was to catch up on what research you've been doing since we last talked, and particularly your talk of today, which had some rather interesting things in it. And secondly, about the whole state of the field, the funding, and the history of it. Let's go back to that bit first of all, because interestingly enough, this morning, there were a couple of talks which went back over the beginnings of this sort of a whole research field in aging, and the beginning of the National Institutes of Aging and so on. NIH's interest in aging. And you made the point that in those early days, which is actually not so long ago, people were placing what looked like long shot bets. I mean, very carefully picking out good science and supporting it, which was not clear to the community in general that this was a good, that these were necessarily good bets to be placing. Could you just elaborate on that?
I was struck because Huber Warner gave a history of how they chose to develop what they called the LAG initiative, which was a RFA, which is seeking grant proposals for people doing research in genetics of longevity. And I was just unaware until his talk this morning that their interest in having an RFA was triggered by two or three rather minor papers, actually. These were not big discoveries at all. Michael Rose had done a paper where he had bred some flies for low fertility and found out that they lived longer, and it was a demographic experiment. It was sort of a hint that there might be a genetic regulation of fruit fly aging, but it was not award-winning kind of Nature article, attention-gathering sorts of papers. These were minor papers. And then one of the others he mentioned was a paper from my lab where we had cloned the gene AGE1. And the identity of AGE1 that we reported in that paper was not really anything to get all that excited about, but it was clear that kind of the first aging gene had been identified at a molecular level. So it was a sort of watershed moment that things could emerge. But I think what I was struck by, and I said to them, is that it was a bold move to decide that this was the tip of a large iceberg, and that they used very weak indications out there in the field to decide this was important. Whereas I've seen other RFAs emerge from, you know, papers that have a more of a feeding frenzy of importance, and so it doesn't take a visionary NIH administrator to say this is going to be important, because the whole world is saying that's important.
Just say again what RFA means to the...
So RFA is a, what is it, something, it's a call for applications. I forget what it stands for, request for applications. I couldn't remember what it stands for.
That's as long. As long as we're breaking down the alphabet soup here, we might as well do that part of it too. You in fact, I think, said something like that you were surprised to even get a grant because you were not in the stream there. You were in the 30th percentile.
Oh yeah, my grant proposal, I mean, it wasn't all that good to begin with, and then it also wasn't judged to be very good. So I think it was the second one I had written for the NIH, and so it really was, and it was also hard to write because we said we're going to work on molecular basis of aging, and we have this one thing identified, but you couldn't really interpret what the identity meant to sort of build a whole story around it. So it was it didn't sell very well, and this was a case of Anna McCormick and Dave Finkelstein, who were the really visionary NIH administrators, saying, "Well, this is one of the approaches we want to foster, so we'll pick this out and fund it out of line." And so they used their discretionary powers to pick this out. And, you know, that was, of course, kind to me. But it was part of what they were seeing as a groundswell of work in genetics. And what I mentioned in the session this morning is that I don't think it's a coincidence that fruit fly genetics had pretty much been the hottest field in molecular biology just previous to that. So from, 85 to 95, the discoveries from fly genetics in terms of how is development controlled was, just the most luminous work being done in biology, period. It was what attracted my attention, that's for sure. And it was what we were seeking to emulate in the developmental genetics that we were doing.
Doing like Seymour Benzer, for example.
Benzer was one of them, Nusslein Volhart, right. Ed Lewis, Dave Hoeganis, Mike Levine. There were meetings where, the early discovery of the homeobox and the discovery of pattern formation genes in flies, these were, earth-shattering discoveries that many, many of us read about, and this was all the kind of the buzz in universities was about that. So the idea that important things could be learned from a genetically driven analysis of development was already entrenched, and the idea that aging could succumb to the same sort of analysis was just good judgment on the part of these NIH administrators, but ahead of the curve. So there were not very many of us working on the genetics of aging, but I think these two administrators, three, Huber Warner, Dave Finkelstein, and Anna McCormick, they sort of could see that it was heading in that direction, and there was a momentum that was coming out of genomics and genetics. And I was just impressed that they could see it in what was not a very clear picture at that moment.
The point I want to go on to now is just to talk about the organisms you're talking about there. You're talking about fruit fly, obviously. We've got C. elegans, the worm. We've got yeast and so on. There's a debate going on, and this is not an esoteric point in my mind anyway, about the utility and the efficacy of using model organisms.
Yeah.
And certainly in institutions like NIH now, National Institute for Aging, there's a lot of emphasis being put on translational stuff. In other words, how does this fit work for human populations?
Yeah.
That's where we're really interested. And I came from a meeting just a couple of days ago where the same thing was being talked at in terms of cancer research. What's the human application here? This is where this really important stuff is. And a sense that the model organism story was being somewhat scanted as not being quite so important. Could we talk about that? Because this is a very fundamental part of how science is done.
Yeah.
And it seems to me immensely important that a general public should understand some of this stuff as well. It doesn't come from nowhere.
Yeah. Well, so I have two responses to that. My first is I have almost a regurgitation response to the term model organism, because it sort of makes out the idea that the only reason to work on these organisms is that they are good models for a human. And there's a couple of reasons why I think that's the wrong attitude. Number one is because all these organisms are ancestrally related, essentially everything a human does, not everything, most of what a human does, besides conscious thinking, probably, is inherited from a common ancestor, and it's a billion years old, and if you want to understand it, you use the tools that are at hand. And these other organisms are genetic Maseratis, and human genetics is like a Ford Pinto. I mean, it's very high tech, but it's not nearly as well developed in terms of how to discover genes. The rate of gene discovery in a good genetic system like C. elegans is something like 100 times what it is in a human system. So just on a raw economic grounds, if you want to discover how animals work, you will get 100 times the bang for the buck working on a worm from working on a human. And that's not an exaggeration. I have one postdoc in my lab doing a screen, and that's the cost of $50,000 a year approximately, will discover 100 genes in a pathway. And in a human-based system, you know, that one postdoc or something like that will work in a team of 100 postdocs and discover one or two, right? So the scale at which gene discovery can take place is just, you know, unassailable in these organisms. So that's one reason. The other sort of response I have is that while NIH exists, of course, to cure disease, and that's part of what we do, another reason it exists is the same reason the NSF exists, which is to understand things. And, you know, we do biology not just to cure diseases. It is a reason why there is such a thing as the National Institutes of Health, but we do it to teach the world how things work. And if we know how things work, it has economic consequences that are very profound, but it's also, you know, part of what it is to be human, is to understand things. So I try to not only stress when I talk to the public about what the health consequences are, but what it means for understanding what life is. Because, you know, the American people should celebrate, not just the American people, the people of the world should celebrate what's being discovered as a great intellectual enterprise, and not just as curing this or that disease.
Now, let's move on to your talk today. And I had a few little notes here, and I'll mention a few of these terms, which were very interesting, and ask you to piece them together. You talked about a tortuosity index. You talked about repellent RNAis, noxious stimuli. You talked about a genetics of nausea. You talked about possibly homeopathy was not so bad after all. I mean, it was very interesting sort of concept. Could you just sort of unpack
so
some
what
of
I was
that
talking about this today? Was what happens when you do genetics and you let the genetics teach you what's important to the organism. So what we were doing was inactivating genes and asking for which gene inactivations increase the lifespan of these worms. And what we discovered is that there are sort of core components of the ribosome and core components of the mitochondria. These are basic elements of cells that when you inactivate them, the animals live longer, and there was sort of a confusion when we were doing this of, well, why would inactivating some crucial component of cells, something as fundamental as a ribosome, why could it possibly would an animal live longer? And the sort of the gee whiz moment was when we realized that these are the major targets of antibiotics that get produced by natural organisms. Think of them as poisons. The natural poisons that exist in the world target these things. And of course, an organism will have a way to know that it's being poisoned because organisms have been poisoning each other for 1 billion, 2 billion years, whatever it takes. So the chemical warfare that exists in an ecosystem is what sort of elicits the power of what we discovered, I think. And so that's when we realized that we are not so much studying aging as studying the aging response to being poisoned. And that what we're really studying here is what we call xenobiotic detection systems. Xenobiotics means the drugs that other organisms evolve to.
Xeno as in foreign,
xeno
right?
Xeno means foreign, and biotic means from other organisms. And so I think we're studying that. I think it's important because I have a sense that it actually goes wrong. It's likely to be very variant in people, and it might underlie various responses. And I think, and this is a pure guess, and it's an anthropomorphization, however you say that. But when these worms are on these poisons, I think they feel this exactly the same way we feel when we're poisoned. And that's why I call it the Nausea Project.
The genetics of nausea.
Yeah.
Right. So You had a couple of animations. I think they were real time, weren't they?
There were pictures of worms that Justine Mellow has made in movies that she's made in my lab, and then she uses a computer tracking facility to then draw the tracks of the worms, and so you can basically track animals when they're happy eating normal E. coli, and when they're unhappy eating an E. coli that inactivates the ribosome or other key components. And what she noticed was that the rate of movement increases dramatically when they're essentially being poisoned. And they tend to move in very straight lines, so you can sort of measure what's called tortuosity, is how often an animal turns. So a happy animal is sort of grazing, just like a cow grazes in a pasture, and sort of happily moving in a random walk. And an unhappy animal tends to really sprint across the scene because they are trying to find a place where they won't be seemingly in the presence of a poison, is the way we think about it.
Now, this is not the same thing as E. coli in your gut after a meal that we've just had, for example, tumbling or searching for food. And
well, it's actually quite similar. The concepts of how chemotaxis works is exactly the same as the way you don't move they do a whole tumble. I forget the name, that they twiddle and twaddle and all this business. But in fact, I think the bacteria that live in our guts are producing all kinds of chemicals that we respond to. And so I think we can't get away from them, but I think our behaviors are going to be strongly controlled by the sort of drug repertoire that bacteria make. Bacteria make lots of drugs.
So can extend this now to somebody sitting at home thinking, what is the relevance of this to me and aging?
So the idea here that comes out of the worm discoveries is that if someone was to ask me what would be a drug that would make me live longer, I would say that the worm genetics says that small amounts of poisons, I wouldn't prescribe people to take small amounts of poisons, but the discoveries would say that what that would induce is a detoxification pathway in an organism that at least the worm genetics said would make you live longer. I think it would be a totally miserable life. I think these long-lived worms that we're making are not feeling all that well, and the reason they're living a long time is that there's a kind of a calculus going on in their endocrine system that says don't reproduce, and if you don't reproduce, you sort of go into the a protected state that doesn't age as much because you haven't yet reproduced. So that's why I think it works. I think when we do these gene inactivations, we're essentially making the animal feel like he's being slightly poisoned.
So is this somewhat analogous to if you apply certain heat shock or stressors of some kind to the worm, for example, chronically, that it also
lives longer
yes, because it's developed?
But I actually think those stresses are less biological than the drug stresses. I think organisms run into toxins, natural toxins, extremely often. And probably more often than they run into heat or cold or all these other things. We're just bombarded with chemical warfare, all organisms.
Right. So this is, and you made the analogy that this is not, this sounds almost like the theory, such as it is, that underpins homeopathy, which is that these tiny, tiny doses repeatedly.
I've already been told not to use that as, I'd rather not refer to homeopathy.
All right.
Because that'll come back to bite me.
All right. I know what you meant by it, though.
But I think it's more like hormesis.
When published a paper in Nature.
Yes. It's more like hormesis, where sort of repetitive stresses will put you in a state of stress resistance. And so think of constant exposure to small amounts of drugs or different drugs as putting you in a endocrine state that tends to not reproduce, to not metabolize fast, and sort of hunker down and protect.
I'm still not following that. I can understand what's being said here in terms of possibly increasing resistance and so on and so forth. Is there some practical application that people could use as some kind of therapeutic intervention that would actually increase their lifespan?
No, I don't have anything in my mind for therapies. What I do have in my mind is the idea that variation in these pathways could have pathological consequences. So, for example, like one of the things that immediately came to mind, as soon as we started to think about poison detection pathways, was what would happen if a human auto-activated the pathway to detect poisons, and that would be why they live longer, right? So, for example, if you look in 100-year-olds, the prediction here would be that the reason some of those people live to 100 is that they, activate a pathway that's could have been induced by poisons, not a lot of poison, but a little bit. And they could, for example, if your body is hallucinating poisons, you'll then be resistant to many poisons, right? Because what happens normally when the cell detects a poison is it activates oxidation pathways that will add oxygen to make it more soluble, transporters to pump it out of cells, glutathionase transferases. There's a whole, there's a science of pharmacokinetics that drug companies care a lot about, right? Because every drug you take goes through a pathway of detoxification and elimination. And so they know a lot about, what happens to xenobiotics in a body. And the question is, what's all the variation in that? You could imagine that there could be a lot of human variation in that, because certain populations are exposed to more poisons than other populations.
So are you imagining, I'm not putting words in your mouth here, I'm just asking, are you imagining some sort of a pharmacological agent that could be used to produce this sort of mild poisoning, if you like, which nevertheless had the long-term effect of increasing lifespan?
I'm not thinking in terms of lifespan therapeutics, because I just don't go that direction, because I think it's toxic to a scientist to do that. Mm-hmm. But I am thinking about, for example, one thought is depression. When people are depressed, what seems like a normal everyday occurrence just has a kind of a dark feel to it. Well, that's pretty much what happens when you're poisoned. Everything seems pretty dark. Mm-hmm. So if their internal state is a state that you would associate with, a toxic, so that maybe that's the underlying basis of depression. I mean, this is really out there, right? I'm not saying there's anything to support this.
Right.
This is just going with the idea to take it to its logical extent. I think about it in terms of people with anorexia, that, what is it about the women who get anorexia that would make the food be, instead of being attractive, be repulsive? Well, if you've been poisoned, you surely don't want to eat again, right? And interestingly, why does anorexia strike, 98% women or whatever it is, 10 times more women than men? It makes sense that a poison detection pathway would be more elevated in females than males, because taking a teratogen when you're carrying a fetus is, mm-hmm. is not deadly to a male, but it sure is to the female with a fetus. And this is why, pregnant women have all these bizarre, food, things that they abhor and, are compelled to eat. So I think about this, our project in Little Worms and lifespan, could have consequences for treatment of anorexia, for understanding anorexia, and we have predictions of what we should see, and we want to look at that. Mm-hmm. So, I'm not thinking about interventions to increase lifespan, but thinking about poisons as the underlying basis of of all kinds of human disease, something as common as depression, and something as uncommon as anorexia.
Since we last spoke, I mean, do you have a sense? I mean, here we are, we bump into each other at meetings and so on. Do you have a sense of really tangible, tractable progress being made?
Yes, I'm very happy with the aging field now, for two reasons. We went through a period of time when we were very myopic as a field, that insulin was everything because of the early discoveries of insulin receptor, and then sirtuins became all the rage. And I think we were almost like a religious cult with these pathways. It was just craziness. And so everybody gravitated as like the one street light, you know, where the drunk is looking for the car keys. And now it's been genomicized in a very nice way. And so the Brian Kennedy's love and Matt Caberline's fantastic yeast screens where they've gone all, you know, found every gene that regulates lifespan. And I think our work in doing genome screens and work in worms has been important. And there's lots of other groups doing that. So I think people have a much more nuanced view of lifespan regulation and are more sophisticated about it and are letting the genetics teach us what's important and not sort of bring in preconceptions. And I'm especially pleased that a lot of the kind of evolutionary theories of aging, which colored the field for so many years, are kind of dying and withering on the vine so that we're not being misled by these ideas that were not really grounded in experimental facts. So yeah, I think it feels great. Meeting's very, very good.
Right. So what do you mean by the evolutionary theories that were not grounded?
Oh, this antagonistic pleiotropy that drove the field. Everybody said, the reason you fill up with stuff that kills you is because it's past post-reproduction. It can't, we're garbage bins of what kills us. I just never bought into any of this stuff. And generally I just ignore evolutionary theory, and that serves me extremely well.
Put you at odds with quite a number of people at this meeting, however.
Not really. I mean, the evolutionists who think a lot, who try to explain aging, that they're on the wane, not on the rise.
Oh, that's an interesting perspective. What do you think are the key areas that we should be following and paying particular attention to as we go forward?
Well, I mean, I'm especially attracted to the people who look in yeast and worms and flies and sort of discover things easily. And then the intersection of those, the Caberline and Kennedy approach, where they say, okay, if it's key to aging in all these organisms and conserved, it must be the ancient underlying pathways that everybody uses. And so then they go to mouse and knock out those genes. I think that's extremely well motivated and smart program.
Yeah. One of the points going back to the funding issue in sort of how you pick the right horses to follow and so on, there's obviously, this is a point I've made with several people, is obviously the disparity between the amount of money being put into treating diseases of aging, neurodegenerative diseases and so on and so forth, as opposed to the amount of money being spent on basic research trying to understand those diseases. The disparity is enormous. So what can researchers do you think, to try and, or what can the general public do? How can more money be directed into the fundamental research?
Well, so I sat on council at National Institute of Aging, so I sort of got to see some of the management of the place. And I had thought when I volunteered for this, or I guess I was somewhere between appointed and volunteered, I had thought, oh boy, we're going to get to sort of make big decisions that will help set the direction. And I mean, unfortunately, the way National Institute of Aging works is the council essentially makes no decisions. And so we would just sit in the room and they would kind of feed us nothing and have us vote on nothing. So it was quite worthless, but I did get to see some of the kind of inner workings of how the National Institutes of Aging works. And the biology of aging, which is the fundamental research wing of it, constitutes, I think, about a quarter of the budget. And another quarter is sort of sociological research, where they do things like, studies to say it's bad to get old, and or studies that say it's you shouldn't smoke, or I don't know what, but it's I've always thought that there's a zero-sum game of money between the various institutes of the National Institutes of Aging, and that the biology of aging part of it is far too polite, and everybody's playing very nice with each other, and we're not at all realizing that if we take away money from the other wings of that National Institute of Aging, it can go to biology of aging, which is a much better run. This is the part that's, you know, was managed so well by McCormick and Finkelstein and Huber Werner. So I'd always proposed that we should have a top 10 list of discoveries every year. And they can put up their top 10, and we can put up our top 10. And let's decide, you know, how much of the budget should one pay, or give us your top 50 discoveries. And let's see how they rate, right? And compare your top 50 to our top 50. And if yours aren't any good, give us 10% of your budget. And let's do that for all of them. They have an Alzheimer's wing that, you know, has lots and lots of people coming up with treatments of Alzheimer's. You know, and the Biology of Aging program has an Alzheimer's part to it, and it's probably doing better work than the Alzheimer's part of it. So I think the budget has been too small. The National Institute of Aging has the worst pay line right now of any institute, which suggests some mismanagement somewhere, that if all the other institutes are doing better at their success rate and the National Institute of Aging is not, that somebody is not managing the funds properly. And I think that needs to be looked into, because there's clearly something structurally not right in that institute. Right now it's something like a 7% pay line, which is just horrendous. It should be triple that.
So if you got to be miraculously appointed director of the thing, what would you do?
Oh, I would shut down a lot of the other research, and I would say, you know, okay, let's put down your top 50 things, right. Top 50 grants, rank them. Let's look at what each of these grants did and compare which is more important. Is it, you know, make some priorities decisions and start to change budgets over time, so maybe there's some chance that I'm wrong, and the sociology of aging is discovering amazingly important things that I'm unaware of, but I don't think so.
So you want the thing to be results driven, merit driven?
I don't think it is currently merit driven between those programs. It's a historical, there's economists and sociologists that are being funded by the NIH for this. And I don't think they're discovering anything important about aging.
I asked this last time, but let me just ask you again, just to see if there's been any change in your opinion about the relationship, the science and society relationship. I mean, you're talking about national institutes now and governmental impact and so on. The administration's been in place for a while now. When the president came into office, he talked about his administration restoring science to its rightful place. What's your take on that now? What do you think the rightful place of science is?
I think it's, you know, science is, if you add up what have been the most important changes in American life in 50 years, I guess I've been thinking about this. I think the computer is probably the most important thing that's happened. And that comes out of scientific research, right? The invention of the transistor, the computer. I don't think biotech has done anything nearly as important yet in terms of industrial production, even though there is a biotech industry and they have done a few things. But in my mind, biotech has been quite a disappointment in terms of, development of important drugs. I'm not at all disappointed with biological research. I think the last 50 years of discovery since the discovery of DNA has been astounding. Mm-hmm. And so what emerges from biology, and the U.S. is still the major power in that field, it will empower the U.S. economy. So just on a purely economic grounds, science is something where we're not going to go into eclipse. You know, making memory, you know, all industry becomes a commodity, right? You know, making cars was the cat's meow in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and the U.S., you know, dominated the world. Now everyone can make a car. We're not going to, have a strategic advantage in automotive engineering, but you know, biotech, electronics, we're still in charge, you know. Apple is not a Singapore company.
In terms of communication of science, one of the things that I talked about today to a group of younger investigators who are interested in how to communicate their work and how they should talk to the media and those sorts of things. There seems to be, a problem in terms of how do you get appreciation and understanding of the work that's being done in the frontiers of science without overselling what's being done. Because as newspapers have reduced the number of qualified science journalists, shut down science sections, there's often less qualified people writing stories about science, and they're looking for major discoveries, major facts, headlines.
I'm bothered by the sort of journalistic tendency to worry about what the readers will care about, right? That there was a moment in time when journalists were a part of an intelligentsia that would actually worry about teaching people the beauty and what's just truly interesting about science. And there's a little bit of that left, but you know, there's so much about, you know, how is this going to impact health, and how is this going to impact your life, and you know, just like these sort of dopey shows that are on after the news every night on TV about, you know, just, you know, I don't know what you call them, but he's, you know, I grew up on, you know, watching the NASA space shots, and the journalists who would cover those would just be all gee whiz about the gadgets and what it means to be a rocket and how do you do things in space. And you know, they taught all us kids how to appreciate science. I mean, it had a certain kind of right stuff, you know, jet pilot, you know, it had a kind of the kind of thing that would appeal to an 8-year-old boy. But they were doing a lot of very good teaching and teaching people to appreciate the wonders of the world. You know, I think it's the role of journalists to do that. And I some of the cable channels are great, right? The Science Channel, Discovery Channel, they're really very good at the nerds of the world are watching this stuff and learning from it and you know, deciding to become scientists. So, you know, I don't feel it's hopeless, but I don't like the common denominator, you know, let's make sure that, you know, we can sell our newspapers. I feel bad about that. And of course, the death of journalism isn't helping, right? The death of all the newspapers.
What's your next step in your research program? What are you anticipating doing? What's your?
I like that we have predictions about human maladies, about poison detection. What I like about it is that there, I think we can do some experiments to show whether that's true or not. I always shy away from human stuff. Because I'm not good at it, right? I don't know enough to do that stuff. But there's some simple predictions that this, what we've been doing, making. So we're going to be looking in that, and I'm excited about that.
Okay. So the field is in a good place at this point.
Yeah, this is a very good meeting, and I'm happy with it.
All right. So we'll catch up at the next one.
Thanks. Okay.
Good to see you.
All right.
Thanks.